Hello, and welcome to Into the Spotlight. I'm Eric.
And I'm Ariel.
And now that it is the month of April, and we have no more Mafia movies to talk about at the moment. Actually, we didn't do as many as I thought we were going to do, but that's all right. But it's time now for Shakespeare.
Yes, in honor of the birth and death of our one of the most beloved playwrights of all of history, we are going to talk about some little known or Shakespeare adaptations that we feel like deserve to be put in the spotlight.
Now, hold that button. I can tell you're thinking of stopping this video, but don't worry. It's going to be nice and simple. And it's a movie, so it's not even a play.
Yes.
But this one in particular is one of my favorites. And it's actually one of the first Shakespeares I was ever introduced to, maybe tied with the Scottish play of Macbeth. I don't know which one technically was first, but it's very, very close. And it actually might be my favorite.
Okay, and so with that, we are talking about the 1999 adaptation of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
I actually did this as a summer school play once.
Oh, really?
We had to hold the scripts because we were like nine.
Wow.
I played Oberon. I had this big paper crown and a little cape. It was great.
Gosh.
We cut down so much of it. It was so simplified. Wow. I think I was the only one that wanted to be there.
Of course you would be. I could see that.
Yeah. So
my introduction to Midsummer Night's Dream, there was like this little like book that we had, like a series of books in my fifth grade class. It was like Shakespeare, but like told through like kids' drawings, like kids would like draw out.
Oh.
And so it was like A Midsummer Night's Dream, but it was like drawn out by like little kids.
Oh.
So that was my introduction to A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
So yeah, and it's interesting, you know, this one, because while it's not as well known as Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth, and part of the reason I think we need to do, you know, an episode about the darn thing, it is, at least as far as I know, regarded as one of his more famous comedies.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people are familiar with like the basic, like some of the you know how like some things have like kind of permeated in like our culture. I feel like A Midsummer Night's Dream is one of those where we say phrases like "ill met by moonlight" or just like the ideas of like fairies and just mix up
a lot of fairy lore. Yeah,
fairy lore, mix up like couples and love squares and all that. I feel like a lot of that stems from this play, and this adaptation takes an interesting approach to it, as we will discuss.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about this adaptation is it's really one of the most digestible.
Mm.
The thing with Shakespeare is if you ever tried to pick up Shakespeare to read, if you ever had Shakespeare described to you in class, I apologize. That's not the way Shakespeare is supposed to be presented. And that's why it hurts our brains so much, is that it's the wrong medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be performed, read aloud, acted. And that's why the movies can be very good. And I think this one in particular does a very good job, because it's all very more digestible.
Yeah.
As opposed to what we are going to try to do to describe it to you.
All right. So in very brief words, do you think you can describe the plot to our listeners in case they're not familiar with A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Three little stories all kind of wrapped together. Love misunderstandings, fairy magic, lots of crazy stuff. So basically you've got like a love square and a few other couples on the sides that all have problems. And two of the couples end up in the woods where the fairies are. Well, that's another couple, I suppose. But all of, you know, these lovers, these human lovers, are trying to sort out their problems in the woods, but fairies like to play tricks. And so there's a magic flower that can make you fall in love with anyone. And at that point, that's most of what you need to know. The rest of it from there is hijinks. There is slapstick. Like, I Love Lucy style slapstick, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is misunderstandings. There are bicycles. We'll get to that in a minute.
Oh my gosh, the bicycles.
There are, celebrity cameos and funny lines that you didn't think you'd hear in Shakespeare and jokes that you didn't think you'd see in Shakespeare. Honestly, if you know anything about Shakespeare, he's really just sword fights and dirty jokes, but
he is.
It's a lot of fun. So it's hijinks. And the thing about it that you really need to know before we go any further, this show doesn't want you to take it that seriously.
Mm.
There'll be times where you pull at your collar a little bit because, gee, you know, that joke might not have dated so well. There's parts where women compare themselves to, you know, a dog or a servant. And you're like, oh, that's not quite right. That's also the point. The people that they're saying it to say, no, what? No, go away. Like,
yeah.
Stop that. And It doesn't make it entirely right, but they do add a fair enough 90s twist on it.
Yeah.
They show that it's goofy, that, and in the end, it all works out. And it's a comedy. It's a goofy, weird, fairy magic comedy that, if anything, doesn't want you to take it very seriously.
Exactly. So what are some choices do you think that they've done? What are some interesting choices that this adaptation does in this one that you haven't seen in other versions of A Midsummer Night's Dream?
First of all, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. I haven't seen that many versions of A Midsummer Night's Dream. This one kind of just scored well with me. I have yet to find dislike for it. I've seen good reviews for it on lists. And I own a copy of it. It's what we watched this time. So it's like, hey, I'm good with it. But comparing it, I suppose, to even other Shakespeare's that I've seen, other Shakespeare productions, movies and everything, even comedies, there are some that don't quite manage to root out the, what's the word I'm looking for? But like the mean-spirited behind some of the jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels wrong. Like, oh goodness, if you've seen several versions I could think of the one with Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, a Taming of the Shrew.
Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I feel so bad after that. I feel like I need to apologize to so many people. And there's other ones too, some versions of Othello that invoke some bad racial stereotypes, but just blackface, but this one doesn't have any of that. And I feel like it, while some of it doesn't age perfectly well, it ages a lot better.
Yeah.
This one also just has a stacked cast of celebrities that all know just how to play their parts.
Yeah.
Which makes it a lot more digestible because you can tell that they know what they're saying as they say it. So then it helps you to know what they're saying as they say it. Michelle, you go down.
Yeah,
you can name all the actors. So, there's so many of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. You have Rupert Everett, Michelle Pfeiffer, Kevin Kline, Sam Rockwell, Christian Bale, David Strathairn, Calista Flockhart, Dominic West, Anna Friel, and even some of the minor like character actors like Bill Irwin, Max Wright, and Roger Reese is just a great cast. Like if you don't know who these actors are, just look them up. You've seen them somewhere. You've seen them in other things. And like you said, they all like it's in some ways you'd be like, wait, I could never imagine them being in a Shakespeare film, but in a way it works. It kind of like their way they like play off like their delivery and how they're able to deliver things. I feel like it just works really well. And we will talk about certain actors in particular. There's some I really want to highlight.
I mean, I never thought I'd see Batman, Theoden, and the bad guy from Titanic in the same room together.
Yes, yes, yes. And you know, I never thought I would live to see the day where a shirtless Stanley Tucci is riding around on a bicycle, throwing like smoke in the air.
Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah. And that's just the thing too, is that there's so much hijinks in this. Even if all of the words go over your head, just watch it.
Yeah.
There's too much. You will laugh.
Yeah, there is a lot. There is a lot going on. Yeah, there's just so much going on. Actually, something I wanted to talk about was just the overall like look and aesthetic, because the story takes place, as with a lot of Shakespeare adaptations, especially in that time in the 90s, they tend to like to put it around like the late 1800s, early 1900s. This one specifically, this one specifically says it takes place in the 1910s, and in this very funny title card pointed out, bicycles are a thing.
Yeah, because let me tell you, when this was written in the 16th century, that's 1500s for you people. Yeah, bicycles were not yet running around all over the place.
Yeah, and so, and for some reason, they decided they really want to emphasize that people were using bicycles. So you see these actors just fumbling around with bicycles, just like, oh dear, I gotta take this bike with me.
And yet the weird thing is, it kind of works. It helps them to move quickly around. It helps with chase scenes. There's some bicycle chases in this.
There are.
It helps, you know, separate the human world from the fairy world.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious to see Stanley Tucci as a fairy being like, what is this devilry? That's a bicycle. Let me poke it. And he does it for like, it's like 15 seconds of Stanley yes. Tucci just staring at this bicycle and poking it, and it's hilarious because he's like, what does this do? The horn.
And then later he's like, well, it's my tool now. I ride
it. And he rides it around. It's fantastic. And see, that's just what the show is. It's like, okay, let's watch Stanley Tucci in a loincloth running around the forest on a bicycle. Like, what more could you want?
Yes, yes. It. Oh my gosh. So that's a very interesting mark on it. So I want to ask you, because one of the biggest, if there's something that people remember, if they know anything about Midsummer Night's Dream, it's Nick Bottom and his transformation. So Nick Bottom is basically this wannabe actor who is very over the top, kind of pretentious, and he's full of himself.
Yeah, he's part of that acting troupe that's also going to practice in the woods. Well, so while Oberon and Puck are enchanting the lovers, he says, oh, I also want to play a trick on my fairy wife. Again, some of this ages well, some of this is a little...
Does not, no.
But he's like, yeah, I'll play a joke on my wife, what the heck. And he enchants her to fall in love with the next face she sees. Well, it's going to be, first of all, this character named Nick Bottom, who's already an interesting looking character.
Yes, played by Kevin Kline.
Kevin Kline.
Yes.
But let's not stop there and have a fairy fall in love with a mortal, a weird actor mortal that's way over the top. Let's give him donkey ears.
Yep.
They don't give him like a whole donkey face. They just sort of make his face a little hairy around the edges, and they give him like the donkey ears. And my only regret is Oberon doesn't get to watch as you got Michelle Pfeiffer in this beautiful, like Cleopatra almost, like fairy gown, being like, oh, love of my life, you know. I would, you know, almost Lord of the Rings-ish. I would take it to Undying Lands or something. You know, my one true love. And he's like, oh my gosh. And he's got the big hairy ears, and he's like scratching himself. And he's like, yeah, I'm the best.
I gotta say, I love Kevin Kline as an actor. He's an actor who every time I see him, no matter how good the film is or how bad, I'm just always so happy to see him. I'm like, I'm so happy to see you. I love you.
This might be my favorite Kevin Kline.
Yeah, and this is no exception. He, of course, does it really well. He just plays it so well. He's
really had fun.
Yes, he plays the pompous ass very well.
And yet you don't hate him. And that's what I love about it. Even while he shows off and while you grimace and cover your eyes, you can't get enough of him. You say, do something else, stupid. Do it. I can't wait to see what else you do.
More, more.
Yeah, it doesn't feel over the top. It doesn't feel like, you know, too silly. It feels just right. Like, I've met this person. Yes. I know Nick Bottom's just like this man.
Pretty much, if you've been anywhere in the theater world, you know a Nick Bottom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very pretentious. He's the guy that says, guys, I know what a theater is. Don't worry. We're safe.
I can play this part. No, I can play this part.
I'll play all the parts. None of you have to worry. You are safe. But it's Kevin Kline, and it's just absolutely fantastic. So just watch it for Kevin Kline, if nothing else. Get a laugh. It's good.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, so yeah. I will have to ask. I always have to ask this question.
Yes.
Is there anything about this that you don't really care for, that you're not too fond of?
The one thing that I always have a problem with this one, is that, okay, so with one of the plots, let's just say that one of the Fairy King, in the end, does remove the charm from the Fairy Queen, so she's no longer in love with Bottom.
Yes.
And even she's like, oh gosh, I was in love with that guy? Well, no, never mind. The only problem I have is that he doesn't apologize, he doesn't fess up, and you still get the implication that he kind of wins, he gets what he wants in the end.
Yeah.
And it's not... depending on your translation of it, you could argue that this movie says, oh, she's like in the clear now, like her vision is clear, and they just both sort of parted ways, because you don't see him get what he wants. He wants another fairy that's in her court that was like someone else's fairy or something. It's weird. It really doesn't matter. But it doesn't really matter so much what he wants. It's just the fact that in the end, it's open that he might get it, and you don't feel like it's deserved. It's like, but... without getting too deep down that rabbit hole, it's pretty easily overlooked. They don't, you know, you could easily say, oh, you know, she's, you know, all cured. She's not, you know, potioned in love with everyone, including him. She's just disenchanted. They both laugh about it. they fly off and enchant the humans with their fairy dust and everything's fine.
Yeah.
If you read it that he technically enchanted her to be in love with him, even though they are technically husband and wife, that could raise a few red flags. It's not a huge plot point.
No.
It's more just supposed to be a let's wrap it up as quickly as possible. Let's clean this up.
Yeah.
That is the one thing I have a problem with. Everything else, and I mean, yes, some of the lovers are technically enchanted to be in love with each other, but it's shown that it's like the healthiest option, arguably. It's hard with fairy magic, and that's why I say you just can't take this one so seriously. This isn't trying to say that doing this is good.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't trying to tell you that this is something to applaud or that it's fine when humans do something similar to it. It's not saying that. It's more just like a very odd snapshot of a very odd moment in a very odd fairy tale.
Exactly.
And that's all it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be morality. It's not supposed to be influential. It's just supposed to be funny.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So
that's kind of the big one for me. Yeah.
Exactly. To ask that question for myself, there's nothing really major that sticks out in my brain. I can pick apart on one hand, I can pick apart like how, like you say, quote unquote, how the look of like the fairies are quote unquote cheap. But at the same time, I don't know, maybe I'm just an old soul cynical person, but I kind of would rather see that than if they were to remake it nowadays, they would just make it all like CGI and look kind of strange. So it's like a positive and a minus for me. Like, they do some creative things with minimal, like, CGI. It's pretty much all there. And, you know, obviously you can tell, like, the fairy world is, it's a set, but at the same time, I kind of like it in some ways.
And the thing about this is that it's not trying to be Lord of the Rings.
No.
Even though there's a few actors from Lord of the Rings in this, at least one I know of. It's not trying to be, oh, here's this great big world and you have to know about all the kings in line or something. It's based off a play, you know, which allows you to suspend, you know, your disbelief, even when you see some, you know, movies about Peter Pan that do something similar.
Yeah.
Where it all looks a little stagey.
Yeah.
But like on purpose. And it still looks pretty darn good.
It does.
Looks magical. Yeah. It just looks like a very magical set.
Yeah.
A very magical fairy woodland that wouldn't be real. I've heard a similar thing said about the 89 Batman film with Michael Keaton.
Okay.
You know, people have said they actually prefer that to the Nolan films where they just shoot shots of, you know, Chicago or New York because that's a city.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Gotham, even while it is kind of a stand-in, really is also its own thing. It's a comic book city. It's not, you know, the city in the state next door, just like Batman's a comic book hero. And that they liked the stage, like the 89 version, where Gotham is more like a superhero city rather than just, you know, somewhere I could drive to in a few hours.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I feel very similar about this. It doesn't look like someone shot this in their backyard forest. It looks like people worked on these trees to make them look just right and very magical, like weird and gnarly, and there's glitter everywhere, but it almost looks like dew. And yeah, you know, Queen Titania sleeps in a nest held up by vines.
Yep.
Like, you're not going to make that out of real stuff. And if you did, you have too much time on your hands. This is, I mean, it's real stuff, but it's not like in a real forest. And
it all
looks right that way.
Yeah.
It looks right. It wouldn't look right in my backyard with the woods. It works on that set.
Yeah, I think it's just more of, I'm sure if like some people were to watch it now, they'd be like, oh, this like 90s, like late 90s, like visual effects. It's hard to describe it. You have to kind of see it. Some people might find that a bit cheesy. I personally find it very charming and
maybe too. A
bit nostalgic. And I am a sucker for the aesthetic of like a 90s period film. I don't know what it is. I can't really even describe what it looks like. It's just something that's in there, and I love it. I will eat it up every time I see it.
Same. And to answer your quandary there about what it is, it's smoke and glitter. Smoke machines and glitter. Rewatch it and tell me I'm wrong. It's a lot of smoke machines and glitter.
I mean, Oberon was very sparkly. I will say that. He was.
But the thing is, you invest in it because it looks really cool. Even if you know it's fake, it looks like a lot of time and effort went into it.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's a nest thing that gets pulled up on vines. There's these weird trees that people poke their heads out of. And they're like, there's a whole party that happens like in a tree grove thing. I don't know what it is, but it looks like it's almost like underground. It looks really magical and weird and fey, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I think that's part of the charm of this, is it does transport you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to suspend your disbelief because it's a play, but it's not a play, it's a movie. And it's, you know, not on a stage in a theater, it's on a set in a studio. But you still get that kind of whimsy, that wonder, the idea that, okay, this isn't, you know, it's almost more like Neverland than anything like Middle Earth or something, you know, it's weirder, except it is, you know, right. It's a forest right next to a human castle with human people that, you know, you can see are very real, and that there's like real doors and real windows, and they're, you know, might be drinking real tea and stuff. It's all right there, but it still doesn't feel like too big of a, too strange of a thing. You understand that they transported into fairy world.
Yeah.
From that, or that they walked into fairy world, I should say,
or they rode their bikes.
They rode their bicycles into the fairy world.
Oh my gosh, where else would you say they rode their bikes into the fairy world?
I don't know, but apparently here, I might have also made a few Fairly Odd Parents jokes while watching this movie today, but it's still a lot of fun. So, that's the way I feel about that set. And obviously, you know, maybe I'm just a softie that saw this movie too many times, but.
Oh yeah. This is only like my second time seeing this movie. So I think I definitely liked this film the second time around versus the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe the first time I was a bit like unnerved by, trying to think of the correct way to put this. Maybe it's not quite erotic, but it definitely has like a highly romantic, maybe not, it's not romantic, not quite erotic, I'm not quite sure where to categorize.
It's a love story that also plays a bit on the I'm trying to think about how to put this, because it's not like it's not totally inappropriate or anything. I could see a kid watching this and just shrugging and be like, okay, you know, there's nothing bad or anything. There's, you know, the thing they might nod or hint at, but not much more than a Disney film might do.
Yeah.
It's not so much that, but it is very much based off of, I guess the term romance might be better for it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, all about, you know, men chasing women and women chasing men and women, you know, being enchanted to fall in love with men and men being enchanted to fall in love with women. Yeah. Most of it is actually men being enchanted to fall in love with women. Only one woman actually gets enchanted in this. Everyone else is untouched.
That's true.
It's mostly the men that have to be told who to fall in love with.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, it's really only one guy. One guy just gets mixed up there. But
exactly.
Yeah, it's really only comes down to one dude.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know. I'd say I could see where you're coming from.
Yeah, although I will say this time around, I don't know why I didn't catch the brilliance of this. I didn't really catch like the full brilliance of like the ending, like play within a play, where actors like put on a play for like the Duke and the Duchess, and they're terrible. It's a bad play, but yet it's just something. It's something so fun about watching these actors put on a bad play.
Like, and it's so weird because it feels like it shouldn't work, because by the time that Nick Bottom, the donkey man, gets disenchanted and returned to his fellow actors so that they can finally put on this performance for all the now married couples, because everything works out in the end, everyone gets married, but now the actors have to put on their play, and Nick Bottom, who is no longer a donkey, is like the star. And you're like, oh, I kind of forgot about that. We have time for this? And it feels like you shouldn't, but you do, because it's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, this is what I've been saying this whole time. This movie, this play, does not want you to take it too seriously because of what's about to happen now. The Duke and Duchess, and these married couples have to have entertainment at their wedding.
Yeah.
And they have a choice out of this long list of like, oh, you could see the tragedy of Troy or this and that. And then this last one, which is like this dumb comedy. They're like, let's go with that one.
Yep.
And you're like, okay. And you get the sense that these guys like made all these props themselves, that they practiced this a grand total of a half of a time.
Yep.
Not even maybe a full time yet. And it's an absolute train wreck, but because the Duke and Duchess and all the couples love it, and they, like, joke along with it, like, oh, look at that, ha ha ha.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, get him, ha! That you kind of get into it too, you know? And you feel like, oh, these are real people that could laugh at, like, a bad home video version of a play that you put on with, like, your kids. You know, when you're in the basement with your, you know, cousins or something, you're doing, like, Red Riding Hood, your parents are like, get him, Wolf, get him, eat him, oh, he died, whatever. It's like when, it's the same thing.
It's like, up for us nerds, it's like watching MST3K.
Or Riff Tracks, yeah. No, it really is, because these guys are absolutely terrible, and they know it in most of the play. And yet everyone just loves it, and they just absorb it. They're like, well, this is us.
Yep, exactly.
And again, it's Kevin Kline.
Yep.
And Max Wright, and they're all just having fun. Yeah, and because they have fun, you have fun, and it just ends on such a happy note.
Yeah, it's great. I can't believe I didn't notice the brilliance of that the first time around. So yeah. So I think now is probably a good time to start to ask the final question. So what letter grade would you give this version, and who would you recommend it to?
Well, I always like to ask the recommendation question first. Answer, I should say.
Okay, yes.
And, you know, of course, if you're a fan of Shakespeare, if you're trying to get into Shakespeare, sure. But to all of you people out there that say, well, I'm not Shakespeare, this must not be for me, give it a shot. Do this before you get into other Shakespeares, I would even say, because a lot of them, besides maybe the easily digestible Romeo and Juliet, but even then, I would say, go for this one first. Mm-hmm. Because it's, once you kind of get where it's going, it's fairly easy to follow along, yet it's also not something I've seen recycled as much as, say, like Romeo and Juliet, where it's like, okay, you know how this goes. Watch this particular version. Just expect goofiness and like odd fairy magic and just weird stuff.
Yeah.
And then just kind of buckle in for the ride. Have snacks, have drinks, have popcorn. Be there with friends who can laugh, and you'll have a good time. Mm-hmm. Give it a shot, you know, be open-minded and just laugh.
Yeah.
Would be my recommendation, especially with good buddies. How about yourself?
I would, very similar to you, I would recommend this to those who are, you know, if you're relatively new to Shakespeare, you have no experience, you're like, okay, I want to dip my toes in there, but I don't want to like fully dunk myself in there because it can be a lot. Even though this has a lot of plot to it, I feel like you should still be able to like digest things, what's going on. You should be able to follow it easily. And, you know, you see a lot of recognizable actors in this, and they'll be able to help you along in that. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a good help. So,
yeah,
I recommend those. And, you know, if you're a fan of Shakespeare, I mean, I wouldn't rank this among like the top tier best, but I feel like this is a really solid adaptation. And so far, this is the version of Midsummer Night's Dream that I would recommend to the most for like Shakespeare adaptations.
Yeah. And don't let the beginning scare you, because there's a lot of talking in the beginning just because they have to establish stuff. If you just glaze over that, even honestly, mm-hmm. and just watch how people react, you'll get what's going on. You'll see who's chasing who.
Yeah.
You'll see who likes who.
Yeah.
And then all hell breaks loose from there.
Pretty much.
Because don't worry, none of that stays consistent throughout the show. So just buckle up and have fun.
Yep.
Now, letter grade, you asked. Mm-hmm. Me, you know, as a Shakespeare adaptation, I think I'd have to give it an A+.
Okay.
Because it's funny, because it's amazing to look at, and because it's so, one of the biggest markers I can give any adaptation of Shakespeare is that you can understand it.
Yeah.
Is that it's digestible. It's that I get what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it's dumbed down. It just means that, you know, honestly, a lot of these plots are very simple once you break them down enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell from the way the actors say their lines, from the way they look at each other, from the way they interact with each other, what they mean. They could be saying anything, but from the way they say it, you can tell, oh, she's mad. Oh, she is happy or whatever. And I'd say this one gets big gold stars for that. As a movie in general, I'd say around A-B+.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, going to win any huge awards that I know of, but
yeah.
How about yourself?
I feel like I would give this movie as a whole, like, very similar to you, where I think I'd probably give around the B+ range. Like I said, it's not like, there's something about it that's missing to put it in the upper echelon of Shakespeare adaptations, but at the same time, there is a lot of great stuff to recommend. Some of the actors, like especially Kevin Kline and Stanley Tucci. I mean, just like A+ for those. It's it's worth it just to watch them. But otherwise, yeah, I say, you know, it's a good, solid film, and I think it's a great introduction to Shakespeare.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time into the spotlight.
Take care.